Welcome to Faith Uncut, a podcast where we explore faith in ways that might get you kicked out of most churches. I'm your host, Mike.
And I'm Amira.
And thank you to everyone who's been sharing and liking this podcast on social media.
We appreciate you.
We got Scholar Diggins. We got a whole lot of people that's been checking Woo-hoo. Us out. Numbers are getting high everywhere. I see you, California. So we're doing good things, and I appreciate everyone for checking us out and helping your friends check us out. So if you can donate to this podcast, you can donate via the website at faithuncut.com. But if you can't donate, you can always like and share and tell a friend. That helps us a lot, too.
It does.
So we're talking biblical literalism today, and I'll see if I can get through this. I want some chips. I don't know why. That's not relevant to the show. But
you cannot eat chips on the show.
That's exactly why I got to struggle through this one.
It's okay.
So we've been talking about the Bible and evil and suffering and those larger concepts. And one of the things that I felt like we needed to address was this elephant. It's not an elephant in the room because people are aware of it. But one of the things that keeps us from understanding and embracing some of those tougher or more challenging concepts is this idea of what we believe the Bible, how we hold it, not physically hold it, but how do we like treat it?
Yeah, how do we consider it?
How do we see it? Mm-hmm. So we just wanted to talk about this and this issue of literalism and how we arrived here. What does it mean? Kind of what was going on in the world that made this, that facilitated this idea that we should be reading the Bible literally.
Right.
And there was a 2011 Gallup poll that found that 80% of Americans read the Bible literally.
Hmm.
That's a high number.
I definitely thought that was a misprint, but okay.
Now, so, I mean, that kind of gives you an idea of the scope of what you're up against when, if you decide that
you're going to interpret differently.
Right. Mm-hmm. You're definitely countercultural at that point. You're fighting a wave. Yes. And the same poll found that most of Americans do not know what's in the Bible, which also makes a lot of sense.
It does.
Considering like how much of the Bible we get, a lot of people only get what's in church.
Right.
And if they're reading on their own, they're typically reading the things or the type of things that you would read in church.
Mm-hmm.
So either you're reviewing your notes or messages, or you're looking through things that are familiar to you.
Right.
And you're not like just reading through, because a lot of people find the Bible intimidating. And like, where do you jump in? It's like the double dutch rock. You know what I'm saying? Like, where am I going to get into this thing?
Right.
And then you try something, and then all of a sudden you're in the middle of a genealogy and you fall asleep. Like, you know what I'm saying? Like,
I just used to open it randomly and just read around whatever I found.
How'd that work for you?
Yeah, I think it worked pretty good because the truth of the matter is I'm a solid reader and I have reading comprehension skills, and I wasn't intimidated by the idea that maybe it didn't jump out at me. I was okay with consuming a whole book. Like, I think the first whole book of the Bible that I've read as an adult was Proverbs. Mm-hmm. And I didn't have a problem going from chapter 1 through chapter 31 and just, I don't know, taking it all in. But literalism kind of sounds like strict interpretation to me. Mm-hmm. And I think when you begin to consume a lot of it outside of a theme. So like we talk about in church, usually that sermon is delivered with a theme, and you already have a preconceived notion of how you're supposed to treat the text.
Mm-hmm.
When you're not doing that, when you're reading on your own or studying I think you're more open to reading the text to the point that you can make it make sense to yourself, mm-hmm. as opposed to relying on someone delivering the meaning to you.
Mm-hmm.
I think those are going to be two different experiences.
So I want to be clear. I guess we should define what I mean, or what we mean by literalism in this case.
Okay.
It does not mean that you believe that everything in the Bible is literally true.
Yeah.
I think that even in certain circles, or most circles, you would see poetry book as poetry.
Yes.
And I think there's a general understanding that there are different literary types in the Bible.
Mm-hmm.
But those literary types are pretty limited. Like, you have your poetry, you have, like you say, Proverbs, which is your wisdom book.
Yeah.
And so you have different categories. But literalists also view things like maybe the creation story is a literal story, or Noah's Ark, or Moses and the Israelites escaping from Egypt and things like that. Those are literal things, especially Revelation, because the belief is this is a telling of events that are going to occur. So once you understand the Bible that way and you have that many people agreeing that it's this one thing, then there's the ability to use it as a tool at that point. And that's what we do. We use this Bible as a tool. I mean, and it's a tool for a very specific purpose. If we're calling it that, we're saying that this thing does this one thing really well. Like it whether it's that it tells this epic love story or tells, you know, how to be saved or, you know, whatever. It's a tool how we should live. You know,
and we've talked about that previously.
Yeah, basic instructions before leaving Earth. Like the Bible does a thing. It instructs us. It lets us know who God is. And so we can understand it that way. But once you see it that way, you use it to do things. So like you'll win an argument with it by saying like the Bible says, you know, the Bible says this or whatever. And a lot of times it's used to make points that we've previously agreed with.
Okay.
So like if I have a point in my mind, like I used to hate when people preach sermons like that. I'm like, oh, you just wanted to make that point and then you just found a scripture. Like maybe you just did a search and put up one word.
True. But that's what I said. Yeah. Sometimes you want to say something and then you go back and you find something to back you up. As opposed to, I was reading it and I then grew the idea and reached a conclusion.
Yeah. And so when you're seeing the Bible doing one thing or as this tool, you can use it to even make things like policy, you know. Yeah, I'm reading this book now. It's this Charles Sheldon book called In His Steps. It's a 19th century book about this pastor who encountered this homeless guy and no one in the town helped this homeless guy. Then the homeless guy came up to the front of the church one day and was like, you know, y'all are Christians, but no one in this town helped me. And then the guy kind of passed out in the church and ended up dying.
Wow.
And so the pastor got it in his head to say, dude, for the next, I think it was like a year, I want to just ask, what would Jesus do? And I'm just going to respond and do. Now, this is, I know we've been through this, in, you know, in the 20th century and 21st century, but this was written in 1896.
Okay.
And this was one of the first major things. I think it sold 50 million copies so far. But he convinced all these people in the church to start doing this thing. Mm-hmm. And it sounded like this really great, you know, this really great project for all of them to say, what would Jesus do? And then they started doing those things. Right. But the things looked like, you know, silence and speech and, you know, working their way into the town legislature to legislate what would Jesus do and things like that. And so this is the type of things that happen when you believe the Bible is doing one thing. And we can see that now. I mean, it's happening today. So I'm reading this book and I don't know how I'm supposed to not be like, yo, this book is really, this is bothering me a lot. Yeah. But
I mean, if you say Bible is tool, you might as well put out there Bible is weapon. Right. So that's the other side. So without clear intent and without, you know, an intentional implementation toward the positive, any tool could be a weapon.
Mm-hmm.
So we got to put that on the same wavelength, because when you say it happens today, you know, we talk a lot about politics, blah, blah, blah. But conservative Christians at times have used that very same blueprint. We believe the Bible to instruct us in this particular way. And now we want as many and we want as much access to various platforms to implement that interpretation. You see it at every level of government. You see it according to whether or not a state identifies, or if its electorate has come to identify it as red or blue, which is too binary most times to capture the full interest of everyone who is participating in government. But we see that it can open doors. It is the tool of the religion. It puts us all on the same page. It's not like we're reading one Bible and, well, we read different versions. But ultimately, it's not like the Americans get a Bible and the Brazilians get, you know, something else. We all have this book, regardless of what language it's been published in, so that we can find common ground. Because I think that's the other thing. We've been told to go out and spread the gospel. So this becomes a vehicle by which to do that.
And I think that's a good point. The common ground allows you to know something about someone else that you've never met if you share this belief in this thing. And that's a valuable,
and we use it as an identifier.
That's a valuable tool in societies, mm-hmm. When you don't always have time to meet someone and trust them and things like that. But I trust that you trusted this book the way that I do. Mm-hmm. And so that's one of the things that happens. So I asked myself the question, was it always this way? Did we always understand the Bible in these literal terms? And the answer is no. The Bible is an interesting text. Mm-hmm. 66 books of the Bible. The majority of the books are Jewish texts for people who practice Judaism.
Yep.
They do not read it literally. Okay, so this is a culture who is, it's not just a belief for them. This is a national identity, mm-hmm. and a belief. They have the history with the text. They understand that this is how we wrote, you know, during these times. Mm-hmm. And they understand poetry versus how stories used to tell different other larger stories, as we talked about a couple of weeks ago. But they don't have a problem with interpreting literally. It still has tremendous value for them when they don't. And I think it's odd that for a faith, and talking about Christianity now, mm-hmm. to be based on a large body of Jewish texts, to not listen to Jewish people with regard to how to interpret those texts.
Mm.
It seems to me the common sense approach is to say, okay, you've had this, you've done this a lot longer. I understand we're a little bit different in how we see things. How do you interpret this text?
Right.
And then we can have a discussion about why do you see it this way versus this way. And you may find out, like, of course that's a fictional character. Of course, like, right. Adam was a fictional character. That wasn't the point of that story. That was, mm-hmm. was intended it was to show something else.
Right, to deliver an idea. It wasn't meant to quite document history. And we're talking ultimately about literature.
Mm-hmm.
So you do have the poetry books, the wisdom books. You can literally sense the rhythm in mm-hmm. how some of the information is delivered. There are history books there when they like intend for you to follow the development of military strategy, this idea of God as strategist, you know, someone who's going to bring someone to ultimate victory. Even our military leaders refer to biblical battles as an example of leadership,
mm-hmm.
you know, or to demonstrate. So maybe not literal, but these are powerful stories and examples of human behavior.
Mm-hmm.
So they help you ultimately to I think the goal would be, you know, to help you ultimately to understand,
right.
you know, a process or how two entities interact around an issue or around a topic, but definitely not meant to say this exactly happened on this day between mm-hmm. these people this exact way.
Right. And as you read rabbinic texts and things like that, you see that there is not unity of thought. There is room for debate and tension, and people have different ideas and they work through those and they struggle with some of the problematic things that are presented in this text.
Mm-hmm.
And the early Christians were closer to that culture. They were coming out of Judaism. So a lot of the hallmarks mm-hmm. they carried with them, the way they understood the text, the way that they worked through the text. And this lasted all the way up to 1700s. Now, the early church was the Roman Catholic Church. Mm-hmm. I mean, this was like the church until mm-hmm. the Protestant Reformation. Mm-hmm. So for that entire time, the church was so intertwined with the government and so powerful
yep.
that they dictated things like your calendar and how we viewed astronomy, mm-hmm. like physics and science. Mm-hmm. And the church was responsible for all of that.
So let's take one step back, because we're also talking about the Bible as textbook. First of all, education was not always a public function and was not always readily accessible. So the Bible as textbook means that I'm giving you the same set of information with the desire that you are able to draw certain things or demonstrate your mastery over certain concepts. So that's where this idea of the continuity of the information, how did the church become so powerful? Because for a lot of people who would have been interested or selected to participate in the priesthood, you've basically been identified, not necessarily for your piety, but for your intellectual capacity to study the text.
Mm-hmm. I said this goes all the way up into the 1700s. Mm-hmm. This goes through the Protestant Reformation.
Mm-hmm.
So what happened to change things? So in 1618, there was this war, the 30 Years' War. And this war went all the way to 30 years in 1648. What happened was, at this time, this is right in the Reformation. And yeah. you have all of these forces. You have John Calvin, and you have Martin Luther, and you have Earl Zwingli, and all of these people with different ideas. And then you have your Catholic Church theologians, John Knox, and all these other people. Mm-hmm. And they're saying, no, this is the way we should do this. And right. They're also using this to spread out into the lands. And they have military forces. The churches have military forces. The Catholic Church has a navy that they use to spread this word. And mm-hmm. it's a fighting force. Mm-hmm. And so these fighting forces would often clash leading up to this point. 1618 becomes this big war where everyone is fighting. And this starts as a religious war, ends as a political war. But after this war ends mm-hmm. in 1648, this ends with this peace treaty that basically says, look, the church, we're going to have to separate this from
state.
Right. Because we can't go through another 30 years of this. Mm-hmm. It ended basically because they were exhausted. They were tired of fighting. They were upset that the church got them into this. So the church, that was the first real separation of church and state. Mm-hmm. The Pope didn't have any input into legislative actions. There was freedom of religion. There was all this other stuff. And then right after that, you see the Enlightenment. Mm-hmm. And that is where we see a separation now. People are starting to think differently.
Yep.
So before this, with all these different views on religion, there weren't a lot of like atheists or, you know, agnostics. It wasn't, because there was no room for that.
Either you were in or you were out.
Right. So it wasn't that they didn't exist, but you couldn't talk about this stuff out loud.
Mm-hmm.
Once the Enlightenment starts, it starts to affirm these other thoughts. And then you have all of these thinkers enter into the space, and they're creating and they're writing and they're proposing different ideas.
Mm-hmm.
And the church lost its footing as the queen of science at that point. So now,
the intellectual leader.
Right. So mm-hmm. now where the church was setting things, like we talked about before, where the Roman Catholic Church had jailed Galileo for the heliocentrism.
I was just thinking about that.
The church couldn't do that anymore. And so they're like, well, where's our authority?
Mm-hmm.
We're losing to science, because science is discovering all of this stuff, and we can't, and it doesn't, and they're calling into question the things that we believe.
Mm-hmm.
So since we've lost that authority, we're going to regain it through this moral authority. And so the Bible starts to become something different at that point. It starts to reshape into, this is the word of God. This really concrete thing that you could hold.
This is sacred. This is now using more words. This is not to be challenged. This is to be accepted. If you accept A, then you should be accepting B.
Right.
So it's like a back end way to regain control. I mean, if you understand how much of the average person's everyday life that the Catholic Church had reached into mm-hmm. by this point, that's a lot of power to give up. And the fact that the churches had armies, navies, that's an outgrowth of how religion had been used to spread government mm-hmm. and spread, you know, society and community. So it's not for nothing that they had fighting forces, because you had people who were fighting through the Crusades.
The Crusades, the Spanish Inquisition.
Yeah, the Spanish Inquisition, the expulsion of the Moors. Like, there were always fighting forces in the name of God, mm-hmm. however we're interpreting, or however we're grouping, you know, who are God's defenders? Who are his defenders on earth? So the Catholic Church had really gotten too big for its britches. It got to the point where it could be critiqued. It mm-hmm. got to the point where people were asking more philosophical style questions, which sounded like heresy at the time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, are you saying that God is not real? No, I'm just contemplating, you know, how does man come to the conclusion that he believes that he's real? Or some of the stuff that we've covered in previous episode, that he's powerful, that he's omnipotent. These are philosophical questions.
Mm-hmm.
So we're here.
Yeah, so in order for the church to be the moral authority, it has to have something that it bases that on.
Mm-hmm.
Lucky for them, they have this tool right there called the Bible.
The Bible.
Just with a few tweaks, and they can stop fighting amongst each other
mm-hmm.
and start to move out with this unified approach, saying, you know, this is the authoritative word of God. We're not arguing anymore about the Eucharist and the sacraments and things like that. Or, you know, predestination. And all. We're doing the work of the Lord. We're spreading the gospel to the world.
Yes.
This goes all the way until the 19th century.
Okay.
What's happening during up until the 19th century
mm-hmm.
is they've used those naval forces and all of that military might to move into the new world. And what happens in the new world in the Americas is slavery. And so now you have this thing that you cannot reconcile with the moral authority that you're trying to establish. And so you have people saying, wait a minute, how can we have slaves if we're supposed to be doing this thing? And so they couldn't resolve it.
Naturally.
It's an unresolvable thing. You can't do
it. This is why we're beefing now. But go
right.
ahead.
So there became this branch of Christianity, basically Christian liberalism.
Mm-hmm.
And this is the abolitionists come out of this. And so you have this group of people in the North, but the North had their problems too. I mean, they're burning witches. They have slaves too. Mm-hmm. They're doing their own thing. But there's this Christian liberal contingent that's starting to grow and saying, okay, you can't use the Bible like this. And so the counter to that was an even more aggressive form of literalism called fundamentalism.
Yep.
And so to combat the Christian liberals who were trying to pull them in the right direction towards moral rightness,
mm-hmm.
fundamentals were like, no. If you open the Bible and you see the slavery right here in the Bible, we have to take the whole thing literally.
So Bible as weapon, we just identified that at the end of the 30 Years' War,
mm-hmm.
the agreement that was come to was that the church and the state need to be separate. At the same time, between 1618 and 1648, you also have the Mayflower voyage taking mm-hmm. place. You have the initial settlements being established in the United States. The first slave ship gets here in 1619. So in that crockpot of ideas, if you will, newly arrived Europeans coming from this war-ravaged continent were coming here to set up new communities as they thought they would be a new utopia, a mm-hmm. new opportunity to be as close to God as people thought they should be. And many people left Europe not so much for religious freedom. Some people were leaving to be free from religion as it had ever been introduced to them.
Mm-hmm.
So part of the reason why you have fundamentalists who now, when you layer that over where they were geographically and what their economic interests were, and again, people who use Bible as a way to agree upon a certain set of ideals, values, beliefs. Now, if you have a group saying the Bible gives us express permission to rule over others as master, it fits not only your interpretation of the Bible, but it also fits your economic interests. It keeps coming up, you know, whether we're talking about prosperity preaching or, you know, why we still have a pervasive mass incarceration system
mm-hmm.
that has monetized, you know, black and brown bodies or poor bodies. It is because people continuously marry their economics and their so-called capitalist Christian
mm-hmm.
interests. We have not yet resolved that. When you say it hasn't been resolved, hasn't been resolved because of the money.
Yes. And so if we step back from this timeline, this is another reason why it's difficult to resolve at this point, or hasn't been resolved.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you say from the beginning, the formation of this faith, all the way up into the 17th century, into the 18th century, which is when the peace happened and the Enlightenment happened.
Mm-hmm.
So the 18th century, 18 centuries. They didn't read the Bible this one way.
Right.
They were fighting over it, and that's how they ended up warring and all that stuff and, mm-hmm. and reforming. They fought in unhealthy ways and healthy ways. So from the 18th century into the 19th century, your fundamentalism evolves.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And then you're into the 20th century.
Mm-hmm.
Most of us were born then.
Mm-hmm.
So we're talking at most 3 centuries of challenging reading the Bible yeah. this way.
Yep.
So that should cause you to think, do I have to do this? Why have I done? Now, the reason why they read it this way for 3 whole centuries is because, like you said, the economics were in play.
Mm-hmm.
They were moving into northern Mexico and further west into the United States through manifest destiny. And they needed to interpret the Bible that way to justify the slavery in the South,
the
expansion of their territory, and the extermination of the Native American mm-hmm. population. And so that was, that became such a huge deal to them. Now, during this time, the 18th and 19th and early 20th centuries, mm-hmm. you're having things like the Scopes trial and things like that, that are, now you're seeing it work its way into legislation. Mm-hmm. And now it becomes harder to disconnect from, because you've made this the law of the land at this point. Mm-hmm. You also have the founding fathers. This is in 1776. They're writing some of this language into the documents, and those documents are things that we still argue about today.
That's
cool. So 3 centuries of literalism seems to be an insurmountable obstacle at this point, but I don't think it is. I think that we can understand that for much longer, that wasn't the way the Bible was seen.
Right.
And the only reason we see it that way now, literally, is because people needed to do the harm that they were doing.
Right.
And so now, when I see them reading it literally, we're still doing harm in similar ways to what was done in the 18th and 19th century.
Which is why we talk about these things hand in hand with the history, because it lets you know that you're headed for major conflict. So we have already had that major conflict one time between our fundamentalists, or people who were rooted and invested in interpreting the Bible, amongst other things, certain ways, including the Constitution. Mm-hmm. The Constitution is not a Christian document, but it is also not a document that ignores a Christian God.
Right.
The Declaration of Independence is the same. And these are documents that were agreed to in conference. It wasn't just one author who got to write and execute the whole entire Constitution. Members of 13 colonies came together and argued over every clause of that Constitution, because they were trying to set up a government that was different from the one that they said that they needed to be free of the repression from, or of the oppression of. And what ended up happening is this mortgaging of the consequences into the generations. It's the same thing that we're doing now. We're hoping that our kids can figure it out better than we can figure it out. Maybe we can cope with it, and maybe they can fix it. And there has to be, I guess, when you're talking about this moral authority, you have to want to have the will to be able to say, either I'm going to do right, or I'm just going to be in power. It keeps coming up. It keeps coming up as the conflict, because sometimes to do right means to vacate negative access to authority. You're using it for the wrong purpose. It is patently New American to ignore the consequences of our actions for what our overall economic system gives us in wealth. We're not there yet, but we are headed to, or toward, that bigger conflict. The 30 Years War, that's one. The Civil War mm-hmm. was one. The Christian liberals at that time would probably be known as Quakers. And groups like that, groups that, like you said, they were participating in abolition. And then after the Civil War, during Reconstruction, you had people who said, who still tried to maintain this moral authority by how they actually treated people mm-hmm. versus how much they had.
Yeah.
A lot of times, people's goodness has been conflated with how good they look.
Yeah, so you have those groups like the Quakers, the Mennonites, even some branches of Methodists.
Mm-hmm.
They were on the side of actually saying, okay, we should be doing this thing. So the problem is not just that we've baked this into the foundational documents of country and Supreme Court decisions and mm-hmm. things like that. We're still using it because of the thing that Gallup poll found. Like, we don't know what's in it.
Right.
We think it's this one thing, and it does this one thing, and we don't have to read it because we already know what it does. We know mm-hmm. the plot. We know kind of how it starts, how it ends. And we miss a lot of the stuff in the middle. Mm-hmm. And so you can't use it as a tool for some of the reasons that we talked about in the What Do We Do With the Bible episode.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you want to use it to speak against homosexuality, you can. If you want to use it to affirm homosexual or queer relationships, you can.
Yep.
If you want to use it, to justify slavery, you can. Mm-hmm. Or to not justify slavery. Like, it, if you keep reading it, you'll see that the intention was not to build doctrine from this thing. They collected this literature to mm-hmm. tell stories.
Yep.
Those stories are not the license for oppression. Let me give an example of what I'm talking about.
Okay.
I can't remember which episode we did this in. It was a Genesis episode about creation. And we went through Genesis 1. I believe JW was here for this.
Okay.
So we went through Genesis 1 and that creation story where you have everything created. And then the sixth day, God creates man and woman together. Mm-hmm. No, I'm sorry, man, then woman.
Mm-hmm.
It's actually man and woman together in Genesis 1. And then rest is the Sabbath day. And then you see a second story and starting in Genesis 2
mm-hmm.
where it seems that God does everything on one day, but the order is backwards. So, you know, you got humans, man and woman, created at the same time in the first position. Then you get things like plants and animals and things like that, which is it's the opposite reading. Now, why would they put two opposing accounts in this first book of the Bible?
Right.
It's because they're not trying to get you to say, this is how God did it. You know, this is what we should be doing. God made Adam and Eve, not Adam and Steve. It's not to do that. Mm-hmm. It's to show them, this is how we understand God. God can do all of this stuff. And God is so good at it. He could do it backwards. Over 6 days. He could do it backwards all in one day. The point is that God did it.
Mm-hmm.
And so whether you believe that or not, what you cannot believe is that that book is intended to tell you step by step how God did it.
It doesn't reconcile.
Because that's where you get the doctrine. And that doctrine is what's used to oppress people. And those people that you're using that tool against are God's people.
Mm-hmm.
So I believe it is critical that we get away from this very recent literal view of reading the Bible.
Mm-hmm.
Because that was never the intention of the authors. That was never the intention of the compilers. That was not what it was supposed to be for.
Right. These are positions that you reach via critical thought. These are not emotional positions. These are positions that tell you that, just like you would analyze a situation in history. If I brought up 4 or 5 different books about the Civil War, each book could make one of the major factors contributing to that war the major factor, right? So we disagree. There are people who are still run around and say, it was not about slavery, it was about states' rights,
mm-hmm.
right? And then I can find documentation. I can do research that will reinforce that it is about states' rights. And, you know, I can do other research and say, no, it was about the peculiar institution and the economics of slavery. Those two thoughts are actually married down the line, that it was about a state's right to participate in the peculiar institution and the economics of slavery. That's a complete thought. It's not either or, but you keep these thoughts disparate because one almost condemns your actions.
Mm-hmm.
One clearly shows something honorable and mm-hmm. one clearly shows something detrimental,
mm-hmm.
entirely detrimental to the establishment of a society. What I'm thinking has happened over the last 3 centuries is that it was toyed with the type of authority and power that the church previously had. These are people who would have remembered their cultural stories, the fact that we pass oral histories. It would have been told to them, you know, once upon a time, the Pope ran it.
Mm-hmm.
You understand what I'm saying? Now, anybody who understands anything about power and has access to books, literacy was not a given for the greater segment of the population. So you didn't have, when you're talking about people working as serfs, you know, on feudal land plantations in Europe, you're not talking about people who then retired from a day of work and then went and read the newspaper.
Right.
They went to church and listened to someone tell them a bunch of stuff in a language they didn't understand, because they were most likely talking in Latin.
Mm-hmm.
To exclude you from being able to interpret it yourself. We've talked about, I ban you from reading and writing for yourself so I can tell you what I want you to know.
Right.
It is the same thing. And it always leads to major conflict, because humans are not meant to behave that way. We're mm-hmm. not meant to be stagnant. We are meant to be fed and to grow. And it usually happens like this critique, like we're talking about, you know, people who said the Bible wasn't intended to be used this way. And it keeps coming up to me like, okay, they were doing a podcast. Like they were doing this.
Yeah.
They were critiquing, they were questioning, and were not afraid of where the conversation would lead them. because ultimately they were doing it because it's right, mm-hmm. not because they wanted to control the outcome.
Yeah. So we've done 3 weeks of challenges. One to, like, what do we do with the Bible? One to, how do we arrive or how do we deal with evil and suffering? And mm-hmm. now how we got to this period of literalism and how we read the Bible in this 21st century. I can hear people asking, all right, Mike and Amira, now if I listen to what you're saying, then what do I do now? Like, what's next? And that's a valid question. First, what's next is stop using this to hurt people. That's the first thing. So we see what happened with the United Methodist Church earlier this month. And we see that they basically opted against the One Church plan, choosing not to affirm their LGBT family members that are part of that denomination because that was the tradition. Mm-hmm. The tradition ain't that old and is based on something that's not the intent of the book that they're right. reading.
It is the core of anti-intellectualism.
So we have to be able to stop this. That's the first thing. Stop what you're doing.
Okay, that comes to your will, though.
Yeah.
You have to have the will to stop.
Yes, yes.
You have to have the will to stop. And ultimately, we're talking about denominations that, while we want them to implement, you know, worship and understanding and community in a certain way, these are also huge entities. I don't want to call them corporate, but they have assets, they have interests, they have interests on every level of society. So sometimes, again, you have to do so much more legwork to ensure that you are turning the heart of the organization. Obviously, that hadn't happened
right
for them.
So, okay, so after I do that, you know, what does this mean about my salvation? And where do I go after I die? And all of those things. Mm-hmm. First, I will say, continue tuning in to Faith Uncut because we are going to deal with this. But here's the thing. Start the journey.
Yeah.
Start to unravel this ball and say, hey, this is a little bit messier than I thought.
And it's okay.
It's not clean. And it's okay.
And it's okay.
But what does it mean? Read it. Find out what's in it. Find out what that means for you, what that meant for the people at the time. This is a journey of faith discovery, and it's the best journey you could take if you stop taking all
stop
at once.
Stop being lazy.
Stop being lazy. Like, you don't have, they're not reading this to you in a different language. I mean, it's in English, which is not the languages, right. But still, you have access to this material, mm-hmm. and you can actually open it and see what's there and form an opinion. We can get back because at this point we are in a reformation. Mm-hmm. This is
happening.
Luther nailing the 95 Theses to the door of Wittenberg Church.
Right.
This is what's happening now. So don't be the Catholic Church and be like, we've always done it this way. Mm-hmm. We haven't. We've done it this way for like 3 centuries. That's it.
Right.
Be the person that says, I want to read this the right way. I want to do the right things with it.
Right. And read more in general.
Read more in general, yeah. Not just this. There's plenty of things to read.
Right.
So anyway, that is our quick hot take on biblical.
Our overview. Yeah. And kind of, you know, went over a few things. Things going to come up again.
Yeah, we got lots more to talk about. So if you like the episode, talk back to us. Let us know how it's going for you. If you want us to switch it up, y'all need to go back to talking about social justice every week, you know. So whatever. Just let us know. We'll be back here again next week for Faith Uncut. I'm your host, Mike.
And I'm Amira.
For more on Faith Uncut, check us out at faithuncut.com.